Leaders of the world's richest nations wrapped up their meeting in Sea Island, Georgia yesterday. According to a White House press release, members of the Group of Eight, or G8 as it's known, reaffirmed their commitment to the Action Plan on Science and Technology for Sustainable Development adopted at last year's meeting in France. The group also announced a new program, the Reduce, Reuse, and Recycle 3R initiative, meant to encourage more efficient use of resources and materials. In the same press release, the White House said it reaffirmed the conviction that, quote, cooperative scientific research on transformation technologies offers potential to improve public health by cutting pollution and reduce greenhouse gas emissions to address the challenge of global climate change, close quote. In a separate statement, President Bush also spoke of a global HIV vaccine initiative to accelerate the efforts of scientists to defeat HIV/AIDS and pledged and said the leaders pledged to break the cycle of famine in the Horn of Africa. Sounds good, but how will it all work? Will the world's richest nations find the money to pay for their pledges? Is science and technology the key to solving the problems of the poor? That's our topic this hour. I hope you'll join the conversation. So give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And now let me introduce my guest. Jeffrey D. Sachs is the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and special advisor to United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan on the Millennium Development Goals. He joins us from member station WBUR in Boston. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Sachs.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
So if I am understanding the messages or the statements that the White House included in its press release today, it sounds like the G8 and the White House is endorsing many of the programs and ideas that you're in favor of for the developing world. So am I reading this properly, or is there something here that doesn't quite meet the eye?
Well, you're reading it properly, but whether the words are followed by action is quite another matter. And I think on the whole, this was a very disappointing summit indeed. There was very little substance to it. There are a couple of initiatives, but in general, the governments, and especially our own, simply has not put the resources behind these initiatives, and so they haven't amounted to what they could potentially amount to.
Well, it seems to me there's two issues here, and I don't know. I hope we get a chance to look at them separately. But first of all, are the leaving aside the willingness to pay for the programs, are they at least talking about the right kinds of programs?
It's interesting that science is coming onto the agenda as it really needs to. It is also important to understand just how weak the scientific inputs are into this process in the United States government right now. There are very, very few people in the government that are interested both in development and in science. And so the connection is a very weak one, even though it's heartening to see that at least the direction is there. There's more talk about science and climate change. There's more talk about science and disease. There's more talk about science and proper environmental management. That's all crucial. But again, the question is whether we're really making progress or whether it's just words.
Well, let's just pick one of those topics. Why don't we talk about science and health in the developing world? What should be or what is the connection between, you know, developing new AIDS drugs for the developed world, let's say, and getting them somehow to people in the developing world? And, you know, how does that work? Is that going to solve the problem, or is that just a handout that will, you know, like putting on a Band-Aid and the problem comes back?
I think it's always important to distinguish two different aspects of this problem. One is the mobilization of existing science and technology to solve these problems. And the second is the research and development of new technologies. Now, you take one of the main killers in the developing world, malaria. This is a devastating disease that not only creates mass tragedy, but upends whole economies, and particularly is one of the main factors in Africa's prolonged, seemingly incessant economic crisis. There's been a tremendous amount of research for many, many years and to show that there are effective technologies available right now, both to control the transmission of the disease and better medicines than those that are in use to actually save people that contract the disease. But in this case, the science and technology just has not been brought to bear. What the analysis has shown is that if you want to use the new technology, some of them very simple, like bed nets that are impregnated with insecticide and stop the transmission of the disease, or new drugs, the so-called artemisinin-based combination therapies using a molecule that was isolated originally by Chinese scientists that's probably the most effective anti-malarial drug around. To do that, it would cost probably about $3 billion a year for Africa. Now, that's not a lot of money because we would save millions of lives. It's less than we're spending in 1 month in Iraq, for example, well less. And yet, what are we actually doing? What is the rich world doing about that science and technology that's already proved? Essentially nothing right now. The total donor contribution to malaria control is on the order of about $100 million a year, roughly 1/30 of what clear and detailed analysis shows would be needed. Now, we could turn to the second part of that also, which is that in addition to bed nets and good medicines, there's also a very real prospect of a malaria vaccine. In the past couple of years, there's been a mapping of the genome, both of the mosquito that transmits malaria and the parasite, the protozoan, Plasmodium, which is the malaria infectious agent. We now have many, many new potential targets for a vaccine as well as for anti-malarial drugs. But then you ask, what is the pharmaceutical industry doing, or even what is NIH doing about these new targets? And the answer is amazingly little. Because science and technology, just like everything else in our society, follows the market. In part, it follows the commercial market. The drug companies aren't interested in malaria. Partly, it follows the political market. What are the congressmen interested in? And they, of course, push NIH to the interests of their constituents rather than broader scientific potential, which is also of interest to their constituents, but just a little bit less directly. So the answer is both on existing science and technology and on the potential for new science and technology, the gains would be phenomenally large for the poorest countries, real breakthroughs. They really are at hand.
Right.
But then you just don't see the investments being made.
Well, of course, that's the problem. And I'd like to invite our listeners to join this discussion. Our number is 800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. But let's just stay on the topic of malaria for a second. If you've already got a proven prevention strategy in impregnated bed nets, and if you've got a reasonably inexpensive drug treatment using artemisinin, what value is there in pushing ahead, or what's the hope in pushing ahead with what would undoubtedly be a more expensive approach of vaccination, certainly in terms of research effort, if you can't even implement the low-cost technologies that would help?
I think that there are two answers to that. First, a vaccine would be a vast simplification and improvement on the bed nets and the anti-malarial drugs. So in this sense, the current technologies that we have that are proved in many trials could reduce dramatically the number of children that are dying. It's perhaps going to be about 3 million children dying of malaria this year in sub-Saharan Africa. And this combination of prevention and treatment could certainly reduce that substantially. Many trials of the bed nets alone show that you can cut all-cause mortality in African villages by half or more through the widespread use of these nets. But a vaccine, if it's truly an effective vaccine that right. That both works and has a prolonged effect, would be a remarkable step forward compared to this technology. And that's the second point, which is that what we've seen in this kind of situation is that when you have a greatly simplified technology like an immunization, even in the most desperately poor places in the world, it's been possible to deliver that when the cost is low enough and, say, when it's one time every few years. Right. And so we would, in the end, save a lot of lives and a lot of cost if we took the next step. That's no excuse not to take the first steps, though. And there is no fundamentally deep reason why we haven't taken the first steps except the fact that we seem to have an almost unlimited capacity to neglect absolutely urgent matters in the world when they're taking place in the poorest countries in the world. We simply don't pay attention until some disaster hits us, and then we may open our eyes.
Well, the term out of sight, out of mind springs to mind, but let's invite our callers to give their view on this topic. Aaron in Ann Arbor, Michigan, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I want to say I've always been very fascinated by your career, Mr. Sachs.
Thank you.
My question comes from an ad I saw some years ago when I was in England. It basically said something to the effect of, if everybody in the world was fed like people in America are fed, we would need 8 planets, I believe is what it said. And that kind of gave rise to a personal thought that I've been working with on some other stuff, and that is having space play a major role, outer space play a major role in both the economic health and the ecological health of our planet. And I'm curious as to how you, if you do see, and how so, space business playing a major role in the near future as a significant factor to help allow for the balance of economic growth and ecological safety. And to make a specific point compared to your malaria thing, as you say, part of the issue is making sure there's enough money available there. And if space were to be utilized as I believe it could be, I could see it having the money necessary to that we would be able to develop this stuff. And how do you see it playing a role, or do you not see it playing a role in the near future?
Interesting question. What do you say, Dr. Sachs?
Well, it is a good question. Let me turn first to this question about 8 planets needed to feed us, because this is another area, food security, where good science, very straightforward and very important good science, can make a huge difference. What you see is that where people are hungry, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, where maybe 30% or 40% of the children are chronically undernourished, this is linked in Africa very much to very low food productivity, the amount of food that you get per hectare. And when scientists, including my wonderful colleague, Dr. Pedro Sanchez, who won the World Food Prize last year, have looked closely at why Africa's agricultural productivity is so low, they find that it's quite discernible. It can be scientifically picked apart. And what Pedro Sanchez has shown in repeated studies is that in large parts of Africa, the soils have absolutely been depleted of nutrients through a tremendous amount of farming that has not replaced the nutrients taken out with the harvest by new nutrient input, either chemical fertilizers or other means. One of the things that he, as a soil scientist, has done is shown how you could have essentially an organic pathway for raising soil nutrients by particular crop rotations that use so-called agroforestry techniques, that is, planting leguminous trees that fix nitrogen, and that if they're used in the appropriate way in the right species, can add the nitrogen to the soil to allow crop yields of smallholder African farmers to triple. Now, the point here is we wouldn't need 8 planets. We just need to be using the planet that we have well by recognizing that agronomic science needs to be applied in Africa the same way that it's been applied in other parts of the world. The
Dr.
problem
Sachs,
is,
I'm gonna,
oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sure. Just, I have to interrupt you briefly because we have to take a short break, but we'll be right back to continue this discussion about, it sounds like we're talking about sustainable development. Please stay with us. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palca. We're talking this hour about the problems facing the world's poor with my guest, Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and special advisor to United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan on the Millennium Development Goals. And Dr. Sachs, I interrupted you as you were finishing a description of how, through rather low-tech approaches of crop rotation, it would be possible to restore fields that had been, you know, pretty much depleted of their nutrients to a state where they could produce a healthy number of crops that people could eat, and as a way of providing food.
And I could add that this has been shown now for about 200,000 smallholder farmers in Africa with enormous success. But then when one comes to try to scale this up, what we find is, again, the donors, like the United States government and others, aren't aware of the science. They're busy giving lectures to these countries about market reform rather than understanding that in this case the essence is the soil nutrients. And the United States, ironically and kind of amazingly, ends up spending billions on emergency food relief rather than even tens of millions on helping a scientific approach to raising food production in the countries where we end up sending the emergency relief. Again, I think it's very misguided, and it's a result of really a lack of attention and a lack of role of appropriate scientific expertise within budget-constrained development agencies. In other words, we're just not putting in the effort to even find out these basic facts within the U.S. government.
Our number is 800-989-8255. Let's invite our listeners to join this discussion. Lara in Phoenix, Arizona, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello. You're welcome to the program.
Thanks. Hi. I'm really glad you guys are doing this topic. I think it's something that's really important. And I'm a physician, and I'm working on a master's in public health right now. And it, as Dr. Sachs was saying, the science is out there, and it seems self-evident that it works. And my question is, has the scientific community tried interacting with the marketing community, the media, to bring these issues to the public in a really powerful way that would possibly motivate more of a political stress being put on the United States and other countries?
Dr. Sachs.
This is a very good question. It has happened on occasion. It certainly, with a long delay, has finally started with AIDS, and the public clamor did get our government to start moving many, many years after it should have and after the HIV virus had spread tragically and unnecessarily to tens of millions before we really started control. Rotary International took up the challenge of polio, and we are on the verge of actually eradicating polio. It's already been eliminated over vast portions of the world. But it hasn't happened in many, many other areas. And malaria is one obvious area where public awareness really could make a huge difference. And I'm hoping that we're going to get to that very soon. Hunger is another area where Americans are very concerned and have been willing to send surplus food from our country, but have been unaware of the opportunities to really help farmers in the impoverished places raise their own productivity adequately. So I think the point is very well taken. There's much more that can be done. It's a hard effort, and it would really help if we had some national leadership on these issues, which we have not had.
Laura, thanks very much for your call.
Thanks.
Let's go to Teresa in West Bloomfield, Michigan. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. Dr. Sachs, I am just so glad to hear you speaking about this. I recently got a book called The Soul of Money by an author named Lynn Twist, who you may know or have heard of. She's been the director of the Hunger Project for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And her book is totally, completely addresses what you're talking about and how, you know, it's interesting how I just heard you discussing about the crop rotation in Africa and how when it gets to a certain level that the donor countries start to, or they're certainly not acknowledging it. And I would suggest that there may be, you know, another agenda that they're not acknowledging it for. But I just wanted to ask you, I suppose, mostly to comment, just thank you so much for being on the air and having Dr. Sachs on the air, but also to ask you, as a scientist, if you've had direct contact with politicians or any of your colleagues and actually run up against these problems, and I suppose, much like the last caller, had any opportunity to make any political impact that you may have felt was relevant.
Interesting. Teresa, so Dr. Sachs, I mean, you've certainly met political leaders. What kind of reception are you getting in this country?
Well, I meet them all the time, and I'll give you an interesting little exchange. I was in Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia, recently, and a USAID official came up to me to bemoan the fact that the United States had spent tremendous amounts of money, and I think very generously, giving food aid, but almost nothing on help with agriculture, especially with the scientific base of agriculture. Now, I was quite surprised, actually, that a USAID official would be so outspoken to me in this way, complaining. And then she added, and by the way, I'm retiring this Saturday. And that helped to explain what sometimes isn't put so transparently. The fact of the matter is that we don't hear very much about these issues. We don't hear very many speeches by the President of the United States talking about the fact that the world is unstable and dangerous for us because billions of people are chronically hungry or chronically sick or chronically wondering how they're going to survive and how their families are going to survive economically. And so I believe that we're fighting this war on terrorism and instability in a very superficial way. We're spending right now about $450 billion on the military and $15 billion, that's 1/30 of the military spending, on development assistance. And I happen to believe that you can't fly an airplane on one wing. And similarly, you can't fight a war on instability on a military wing alone if you don't address the much more fundamental problems of disease and hunger and all the instability that we know they cause. This just seems to me to be a political mistake.
Well, let me tax you on that just a little bit. Can you explain why, you know, the health problems in sub-Saharan Africa represent a threat in some way to the United States of America, because that seems to be the argument that this instability leads to something that we will have to pay to address militarily?
Well, let me give two answers to that. First, you might think about a science fiction movie where a dread disease emerges from the jungles of Africa and unbeknownst to us travels around the world. And, of course, it wouldn't be science fiction. That would be the HIV virus, a disease which the genetic clock shows probably emerged in West Africa as a zoonosis, a transfer from probably chimpanzee populations to the human population, perhaps in 1930 or 1940. It was not monitored, not surveyed, not studied, not identified until it hit San Francisco in 1981, by which time this virus was worldwide. So this kind of global risk, which we also were briefly aware of with SARS last year, and then we seem to forget very quickly once again, is something that is with us in a global society that we live in. So the idea that somehow we're isolated and protected, even in our mere public health, is obviously false. But there's another answer that I could give, and I would just direct you to the generals and intelligence strategists that are now starting to pump money into Africa because they're understanding that places like Somalia are not only unstable and were sites of U.S. Loss of life, but also are staging grounds for terrorism. There are new East Africa initiatives, new Sahel initiatives, the Sahel being the area between the Sahara Desert and the more humid parts of equatorial Africa. And the U.S. is starting to spend militarily in these areas, hundreds of millions of dollars. We probably don't know the full extent of it. I see generals and military attachés around as just more present at the embassies and so forth than in the past. But what I don't see is a clear understanding that Africa's stability is not going to be achieved by having American troops or spooks on the ground. It's not going to be a matter of spies and intelligence and the military if Africa remains absolutely destabilized by hunger and disease. Africa's a place so shocking where when the rains fail, you see a statistically significant increased probability of violence and war. That means a place that's living so close to the edge of survival that a crop failure triggers mass violence. That's not something that the military is going to solve. That's something that the agronomists could help solve.
Let's go to Stanley in Bishop, California. Stanley, welcome to the program.
Yeah, one thing that you haven't addressed to any great extent is how is it possible to achieve this great improvement in agricultural output in an environment that's so unstable as a result of the political leadership in these various African countries. I mean, for example, like recently in Zimbabwe, their great leader has taken over the farms from the white people and distributed it amongst his friends, and as a result has reduced the food production in that country to a great extent.
Interesting question, Stanley. What do you say to that, Dr. Sachs?
Yeah, Stanley is right that in certain places the prime obstacle is local politics for sure, and I think he's right that Zimbabwe is one of those places. But sub-Saharan Africa, which, by the way, is just one of the poor parts of the world and unstable parts of the world, sub-Saharan Africa is 49 countries with a wide variation in governance performance. There are many parts of sub-Saharan Africa that have remarkable governance given the extent of the poverty. You can't even imagine how they hold things together, much less make such innovative and coherent programs. I'm thinking of places like Senegal or Ghana, where in West Africa you see tremendous governance and yet this terrible problem of low agricultural productivity, and where they've designed programs that they just can't get the help to actually carry out, contrary to the promises that the United States and the other rich countries have made. In other places, the political instability is clearly the major obstacle. My own view is that we ought to help those that are ready to help themselves. We ought not only to help their people, but also to set up examples and to set up some real success stories in Africa as illustrations to other places in Africa of what can really be accomplished when governance is good internally, so that there are no more excuses. But unfortunately, even when you have good governments trying their best, you just don't have the kind of response from the United States that you would expect. In Kenya, for example, where we know there is tremendous suffering and where Kenya is bearing the brunt of our war on terror, we gave travel advisories against going to Kenya. The State Department did as a new democratic government was coming in last year. What kind of help are we giving? Well, I'll tell you, they have about 5,000 doctors and nurses that have been laid off as a result of a financial squeeze under an IMF-supervised program. It would cost about $60 million a year only. This is about 6 cents per person in the rich world to enable the Kenyan government to rehire those doctors, nurses, and health workers. I've been trying for months now to get our government and other donor governments to bear that 6 cents per person in the rich world, and you can't get an answer back. You say, well, this has to be studied. This can't just, you just can't hire doctors and nurses. And the result is excuse, delay, and ongoing disaster.
I need to remind everybody that I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking with Jeffrey Sachs, the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and let's go to David in Detroit, Michigan. David, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a professor of urban affairs. I've been studying urban poverty in the United States for over 25 years, and one of the things that never seems to get discussed is, as a society, in this society, we have more or less abandoned a whole range of approaches under the name of science. For example, we've shifted public health from, people used to die of poverty, now they die of specific diseases, and we've shifted to an eradication of the disease and not the cause of the disease. For example, tuberculosis now is making a resurgence among the poor in the United States. My basic question, and I can go on and on about this, why is it so surprising, and I'm equally critical, but why is it so surprising that we as a nation who have a, let's say, abandoned the agenda within our own country, that we then pay at best lip service and do very little abroad? I mean, it's we tend to forget the need here, and so we don't pursue the need elsewhere, and that is, you know, I mean,
interesting point. I think what you're saying is, if we can ignore the problem in this country, how are we supposed to pay attention to it elsewhere?
Why are we surprised that we don't pay attention to it?
Well, that may be better. What do you say to that, Dr. Sachs?
Well, I don't know whether it's surprised or frustration or still hoping that we will get our act together. Of course, I'm sympathetic to what David says, but I would add a point, which is that while we have tremendous and tragically neglected needs in this country, no doubt, the extent of the crisis in the impoverished world really is of a different character. Here in the United States, life expectancy is on the order of about 77 or 78 years, with too big a variation between the rich and the poor. But in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa right now, it is 40 years. And in many places, of course, it's plummeted by 10 or 20 years of life expectancy because of the unmet AIDS pandemic. One could go on in terms of the problems that we have here and the comparison with the extreme problems of the poor in other parts of the world, where I'm urging that we make these investments, and they're modest compared to what we're spending on almost anything else one can imagine, is the kind of poverty that is so extreme that it is killing millions abroad. Not only killing them, killing their hopes for the future, and also killing the kind of international stability that we so much crave in this country and that we're somehow believing that we're going to find through a military approach.
So is there any reason for optimism at this point?
I think the reason for optimism is that the solutions really exist. In many cases with existing technologies, in others which are on the horizon with the remarkable scientific advances that have been made. The more people that understand this, and the more people that understand that basically as a country we make choices, we allocate budgets, so we spend $450 billion on the military and $15 billion on development assistance, the more this is understood, the more we can make better choices. No, it's not hopeless, because other countries in Western Europe, for example, are making much wiser choices right now and devoting a considerably larger fraction of their external spending to these causes.
Can you stay with us for a few more minutes to continue this?
I'd be delighted.
Okay, in that case, we'll take a short break and we'll come back and talk with Dr. Sachs some more. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palca. We're speaking with Jeffrey Sachs, the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. And just before the break, I interrupted Dr. Sachs as he was giving us cause for hope, I hope. So maybe you'd like to continue that thought, Dr. Sachs.
I was saying that the more it's understood that our choices are better than they seem, that we have options that people are not necessarily aware of, that low-cost solutions, but not zero-cost solutions, could actually be brought to bear to save millions of lives and help countries trapped in poverty to escape from that trap, the more I think it's quite possible that we'll take those choices. We're now confronting, more seriously than we have for quite a long time, how the United States relates to the world. We've taken a military approach in the last couple of years. I think people are sensing this is not a sound approach that's really getting us security. And they're asking whether there aren't other ways that at least need to complement some of the things that we've been doing in this war on terror, if not replace them.
Okay, I think we have time for one more call. Let's see if we can go to Jim. And is it Lapine, Oregon, or Lapine, Oregon?
Lapine, Oregon.
Ah, welcome to the program, Jim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering if the World Health Organization or any of the food distribution organizations, are they aware of hemp seed and its benefits in the way it can circumvent the impaired essential fatty acid metabolism of people who have, like, I guess, starved for a long time or lost that ability to digest essential fatty acids properly?
Interesting.
Well, I couldn't give you an answer on that one directly, but the two organizations that are pretty adept at understanding these emergencies are the World Health Organization and the World Food Program. We're working closely with the World Food Program right now on trying to get another one of these absolutely proved interventions, school meals, so the children can learn and so that they can get adequate nutrition, not covering the modest proportion of poor children's schools right now, but get this extended. Another example of fabulous intervention. The World Food Program's done a great job on it, but they don't have the resources to really bring it to bear on the scale that that it requires for a continuing hunger emergency in the world.
You know, I think we only have one time for one more question, and since I'm the guest to be the host of the show, I'll ask it. You know, you wrote an editorial in Science magazine a couple months ago, and you talked about the level of public understanding does not yet exist, that these kinds that these kinds of solutions are out there, they can be implemented at a reasonable cost, and if people understood it, they would embrace it. Do you really think that's true? I mean, are people more interested in driving their SUV and getting a cut in taxes than they are in contributing to a more livable world? I mean, do people see beyond their own doorstep is what I'm asking.
People certainly do, they, in this country, were willing to support huge increases in spending on this war on terror, for example. But Americans also like to see results. When they see one approach isn't working, they want to ask, will something else work? One of the reasons that foreign assistance gets such a bad name in this country is that Americans are not against it in principle. They just don't believe that it works in practice. And that's true if we shovel money at dictators and play Cold War political games and put money into places where the aid gets blown up. But if they understood that bed nets for malaria nitrogen-fixing trees to raise the crop production and antiretroviral medicines delivered in low-income settings could change the face of these impoverished countries and really produce results, I do believe Americans would support this. The problem is there's a lot of ignorance within the leadership of government. It's not just the broad public. It's that we don't have a science and evidence-based strategy for these countries to begin with. This whole process is so underfunded and so politicized that even leaders that really should understand this don't understand it. And so the problems of knowledge are rather pervasive, but alas, include the leadership of our foreign policy in this country, where if they knew better, maybe they would also help to advise the American people on a far better return on their investments in global stability.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Dr. Sachs, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks a lot. Great to be with you.
Okay. Dr. Jeffrey Sachs is director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He's also special advisor to United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan on the Millennium Development Goals.